I'd like to call the committee to order. A quorum is present, and good afternoon, everyone. We have quite a bit of work to do today, so I would like us to get started. The first thing we need to do is move the minutes, and would someone be willing to move the minutes of March 7th and March 25th?
Madam Chair, I move the
minutes. All right. Thank you. Representative Ward moves the minutes of March 7th and March 25th.
Madam.
Now, members, there is some discussion that we need to have about the minutes of March 7th. A question was raised in a previous meeting about those minutes.
Yes.
And as I recall, the question related to whether a member who was present for the committee hearing and was marked present but was not in the room at the time we took a vote, how their name should be listed. And I have reviewed these minutes, and I believe that they are correct, and we're talking about the minutes of March 7th. So is there any other discussion about the March 7th minutes or any more that needs to be said about that issue?
Madam Chair?
Representative Albright?
My only question is, did you review the tape as well?
Representative Albright, I did not review the tape. However, the policy of the committee has always been when members are, I believe in treating members like adults, so I don't sort of demand excuses from members when they're here, when they're not able to be in committee, because I realize that members are multitasking. So if a member is not in committee on a given day, we're marking them as excused, whether they've actually literally come to us as excused or not. And if a member then is not present when we take a roll call vote, we're marking them as excused. And that's just by policy, because they're an adult and we understand that they have things to do and they're monitoring themselves, and I'm not their mother.
Very well.
God help me.
Very well.
So does that sort of explain, Representative Albright?
You're the chair.
All right. Thank you very much. And
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious what the policy is in this situation with someone actually not being present for a vote, but a vote being counted.
Representative Ward, different committees do this differently, and some will mark someone as not voting or absent or excused, and the way we've been doing it is just to mark people excused if they otherwise were present in the committee but they didn't happen to be present when the vote was taken. So they're just simply marked excused, and that's just the way we've done it. Now, whether they're, you know, whether they had an emergency phone call or they're in another committee or they had a headache and had to lie down, it's kind of, I figure it's not my business. And so we simply mark them excused, and I think we're doing that for all members equally. And, you know, if we fail to be equal in that regard, I hope someone will bring that to my attention. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So with that, members, is there other discussion on either of these, the minutes for the 7th or March 25th? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Thank you. Motion is approved. Okay, we will then move on to, we will take up House File 2467, which is the Human Services Background Studies Bill. And let's see, Representative Ward, would you like to take it down?
Chair Labeling, I understand that you have House File 2467 to move to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That would be my motion. And I have an A1 amendment, so I'd like to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order in which I'd like it discussed.
Any questions? Seeing none, go ahead. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carried.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, this is the background studies bill from the DHS Office of the Inspector General. And I have here Mr. Kerber, who's going to explain this. But before I do that, the amendment we just adopted is the result of the hearing that we had in civil law. So that was, and I think Mr. Kerber maybe can give us a little explanation of that, but that was responsive to the concerns members had regarding the data provisions in the bill, because as you'll see, this is a pretty heavily data-intensive type of a bill. But I'm going to turn it over now to Mr. Kerber and let him explain what the department is doing here.
Mr. Kerber, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Jerry Kerber. I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office of the Department of Human Services. And I'll just speak to the amendment first, Madam Chair. This the amendment, as Representative Liebling said, is the result of some good discussion we had yesterday in the Civil Law Committee. And what we're doing here is making it more clear what is going to be included in the privacy notice and what the department is specifically required to include in the privacy notice that's given to people when their background studies are being done. Certainly there are a number of clarifications in the bill, but it wasn't clear that would all be included in the privacy notice, so that's what's going on here. And then also there was some sort of technical clarification language about when we will automatically destroy background study information on a person. It's really when they reach 90 years old. That's when we're going to destroy the information. So with that, I think I'll just give an overview of the bill itself and the kinds of things that we're doing here. And there's a PowerPoint in your packets that, and I did some double checking, I think it is there, and I'm not going to go through all that for the sake of time, but as questions arise, I think maybe I'll be resorting to referring people to some of the slides that are on that PowerPoint for an illustration. But this is in a very important background study bill for the agency, and it's doing a number of things. It has a number of impacts, I should say. What we're trying to do here is increase the accuracy of our background studies that we're doing. We do about 278,000 background studies a year, and these cover people who work in virtually all of the healthcare industry and human services industry in Minnesota. And so if you're working in a nursing home or a hospital or a home health agency, or you're providing PCA services, chemical dependency treatment program, child care center, adult daycare program, any of the services that are funded under the home and community-based waiver, chemical dependency, mental health, if I didn't mention those, and adult foster care, child foster care. It's kind of the whole gamut of health care and human services. Even some programs that are licensed by the Department of Corrections for juveniles. And so the legislature over the years has found it made sense to, as background studies duties were expanded, to put it all in one house here. So the Department of Human Services is doing this really for a variety of different agencies. And it all comes under one law. And because it's all under one law, we're really going to reap some of those benefits with the changes that we're proposing here. I want to explain quickly what we're not changing, because there's always a lot of discussion. Background study bills get a lot of conversation and they get a lot of questions. And what we're not changing here is who needs to have a background study. We're not changing when a background study needs to be done. There needs to be a background study is essentially initiated when somebody's changing jobs. But we'll talk about how that's going to change. But not that activity, not really what the employer does. We're not also talking about what causes people to be disqualified. There's often discussion about what's the list of crimes that if somebody has in their history, then they're disqualified from working in one of our programs. And we're also not talking about any changes to the process that people can challenge that or demonstrate that they've been sufficiently rehabilitated so they don't pose a risk of harm. All of those kinds of things are very interesting and important parts of the background study law, but we're not changing any of that. What we're really changing is sort of the mechanism for doing these background studies. And essentially, the big change here is we're converting it from our looking at criminal records now based on a match of the first, middle, last name, and date of birth, and we're going to switch that over to basing that on fingerprints. And so it's going to be a fairly significant change for how we're doing these, but the benefits are quite quite exciting. So it's one of those areas where we're making these changes, and there really are benefits for everybody in the system. Certainly, we're seeing that there are going to be benefits for children and vulnerable adults who are receiving services in any of these settings that I mentioned. And that's in part because, as the BCA is confident, that we're missing probably 1% of the criminal records now. When you start looking at 250,000 or so background studies a year, that's 2,500 people that for whom we may not be getting accurate criminal history information from the BCA. And so that's going to be an improvement. Also, the system that we're building here, that we're designing, is going to rely on our getting updates of the criminal records from the MINSA system, Minnesota Court Information System. And so in every district court around the state today, there are people entering new information into MINSAs. We're going to be connected up with that. And so we're going to be getting new information from that system throughout the day, even. So we can update these background studies as we go. So the added protections for individuals are going to be much greater in that regard. Plus, the speed of our background studies will be greatly enhanced. And so under the current law, people can generally start working in a position that allows direct contact as long as that background study is initiated. You know, the legislature has recognized that sometimes these background studies in the past haven't been done immediately. And so in the sort of to facilitate this, the law has been clear that it allows an employer to begin somebody in direct contact if they're supervised, but they can work until we get this background study underway. And so because the background studies are going to be so much faster under this new system, the vulnerable adults and children should get better protections. Also, employers. The hiring process is going to be speeded up very significantly in here because as we're doing these background studies now, we're doing like 1,200 background studies today. Every day we do between 1,100 and 1,200 background studies. And almost half of those we're doing background studies on people who have already had one because people change jobs. And when people apply for jobs, they don't necessarily just apply for one job. And so the way the system currently works is when we're getting these requests in, every individual that we're getting a prompt to do a background study from an employer, we're doing another background study on that person. And so then that background study and that result gets paired with that employer. What we're changing here is the paradigm so that the background study is actually tied to the individual. And the individual then can have one background study, one and done is what we're saying, and then for subsequent employers, they're really going to be just verifying that person has had a background study and they can be hired immediately in many of these cases. The employees and workers out there are going to benefit significantly because, as I mentioned, it's going to be faster. So if somebody applies for a job, the background study isn't going to be hanging them up. One of the significant ways that's changing is that right now when we're doing a background study and we're basing on a match of the first, middle, and last name and date of birth, you know, we have a lot of Jim Schmidts in Minnesota. And so if you happen to be Jim Schmidt or you have some other common name, and somebody with a name similar to yours has a criminal record, your background study gets snagged. And because it's snagged, we have to have a person look at that record and verify that this isn't the same Jim Schmidt as being studied. And so in order for us to make sure that we are not missing people, we've had to make sure that the algorithm by which we're making these checks against BCA records is broad enough so we throw the net wider than we really need to throw it so we get back more records on people that then we sort through and figure out, do any of these many records actually apply to the person we're studying? And that slows down that process, particularly for people with common names. Or if you happen to be somebody who, when they were arrested, they used your name. So if you were a victim of identity theft and that person was convicted of a crime, you are listed in the BCA records as an alias for them. And so if you go to apply for one of our jobs, your background study is going to get hung up on that issue. And so, but by using fingerprints, you know, we're going to be comparing the fingerprints with the criminal records, and we almost don't care at all what name people give us. So if the fingerprints match, there's a record. If the fingerprints don't match, there is no record. It's just real cut and dry, black and white. And then the other thing that employees are going to benefit from is not only that speed of getting through the system, but we're also developing a process where people can initiate their own background study. Because the background study is going to be tied to the individual, people will be able to initiate their own and really get that taken care of. If I move to Minnesota and I want to be a PCA or work at a nursing home, I want to be a chemical dependency counselor, or I'm a nurse, I can go into the system and I can initiate my own background study, get it done. I can put on my resume that I passed a DHS background study, and sure enough, when I go for that job and I'm sitting there, they'll be able to verify that. If they go to initiate a background study on me, they'll be able to look and say, oh yeah, you have had a background study, and you're good to be hired right away. No more waiting. And then all of this is going to provide much greater efficiencies back at DHS. And so as this, we're using technology in much better ways here, we're really going to be replacing a lot of the review that we do, that we use people to do, to look at records and make a judgment. You know, that's going to be replaced with electronic comparison of fingerprints. And so in the end, while we're changing this process, next year we plan to come back with another proposal to the legislature that's going to actually lower the fee. Right now, providers are paying about $20 per background study. If you are licensed by the health department, the background study fees are included in your licensure costs that you pay to the health department, and then we have a contract with the health department where they just pay us a lump sum, $1.5 million a year for all their background study work. But we're really anticipating that this is going to be saving money in the end, so that we'll be coming back and then proposing a fee decrease. So the system will be better, but it's going to cost less. And that's frankly how this ended up getting through the governor's office to be an unsession proposal that made it. It's really, you know, has all the makings of more efficient government. So I'll talk a little bit about some of the key parts of this bill. But then I want to certainly, entertain any questions that people have. Some of the key things that we're clarifying, because we're going to be collecting fingerprints on people, there are a lot more concerns about data privacy. It seems somehow different that if the government's going to use my fingerprints, it's different than using my name and date of birth. So recognizing that, we have some provisions in the bill that make it clear that DHS is not going to keep any fingerprints. And not only that, the BCA isn't going to keep those fingerprints either. We're going to use those fingerprints for that background study, and then they're going to be done. However, what we are going to keep is the photo. So the other part of what we're requesting here is not just we're requesting the authority to require fingerprints, but also that the person is getting their photograph taken while they're being fingerprinted. And so that photograph is going to be a very important part for all the follow-up background studies. We've had some interesting stories that we've learned from providers who have said that an individual may come in for an interview. This was a nursing home administrator, said people come in for an interview and they do really well during the interview, very impressive, and they're answering the questions, and they make the person an offer and the person accepts. But the person who comes to work looks different. And, you know, it just kind of surprised me that people do that. But actually, they have somebody else go on job interviews for them. And so one of the things that's going to happen here is that if somebody goes in to apply for a job and they fill out the application and the employer is interested, they'll go into our system to initiate the background study like they do now. And we call it Net Study, and the new one's going to be Net Study 2.0. You'll see that in the bill. They'll go into the system to initiate that study. If the person has already had a background study, they'll be able to see that immediately, and all they have to do is click on the roster to add that person to their roster, and then the person can start working. If they haven't had a background study, then the person is going to have to go get fingerprinted. And so they'll be able to see where the fingerprinting stations are that are available, and we're working with a vendor right now with an RFP, kind of anticipating that some of this may pass. We will have fingerprint vendors throughout the state who will then do this fingerprinting for us, and they're going to charge a fee somewhere between $10 and $15. It hasn't been established yet. But then they will take that person's fingerprints and their photograph. That fingerprint set and the photograph will then be transferred electronically to DHS. We will keep the photograph, and the fingerprints will then go on to the BCA. Then the BCA will give us back a record if there is one that matches those fingerprints, but then the fingerprints themselves are destroyed. In some cases, people will get an FBI record check too. We had earlier a provision in the bill that would say that for PCAs, we were proposing that we would initiate FBI record checks on all PCAs categorically as we roll this out. But we're not doing that now. That's been amended out. But there still are about 18 to 20,000 FBI record checks we do a year now. Some of those are the federally required FBI record checks for people who do child foster care or their adoptive parents. And another group is a group that when we get back a BCA record, the BCA record indicates whether somebody's a single-state offender or a multi-state offender. And so if they're a multi-state offender, then we automatically will do an FBI record check on those people. So in those cases, that fingerprint then will not just stop at the BCA. That fingerprint will go on to the FBI, and we'll get the results of the FBI record using it too. So the security provisions that we have for the data retention, we're making it clear that we are not keeping the fingerprints, but we are keeping the photo. We are also putting in a provision here that will allow people to just ask us to destroy that data. We don't have that in there now. Right now, you know, when we've been doing background studies since 1991, and there is no destruction schedule whatsoever in the law or in any rules, and so background study data is sort of by default being kept forever, and forever, you know, that's really long. And so, you know, we heard an awful lot about that as we were talking with people, and we've had nearly 70 meetings throughout the state about this bill. And we've talked with over 1,500 people, and that's one of the things that came up is that, well, how long does DHS need to keep this information? And can't you have an automatic destruction? And can't you respond to me if I want you to destroy my records? How about that? And how about some other, you know, how about this photograph? Can you automatically get rid of that at some point? And so all those provisions are actually in the bill. And so there's a provision in there, and it's clarified in the amendment, that if somebody at their 90th birthday will destroy all their background study data. There won't be any reason for us to keep it after that. And 90 was kind of modeled after the Data Practices Act, and data on people, data on decedents becomes public, you know, at 90 years after it's created, and or after the 90th birthday, and so we thought, well, rather than make this information public, certainly we'll just destroy it that day. So it, at least it provides something, and I suspect we'll be talking about that more in years to come. Okay, so there's a few other provisions in here that. The data is going to be encrypted at the database level and encrypted at every point of travel. And so we've really spent a lot of time on this bill, tailoring it to at least address all the issues that have been brought to our attention. Not to say that everybody's completely satisfied, but how about if I stop at that point and just see if there are any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kerber. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kerber. Is this the bill you talked to me about in the fall that'll require 250,000 Minnesotans next year, not this year, but next year, to have their fingerprints taken?
Madam Chair, Mullery, this is the bill I talked about. Yeah. Now the number is going to be interesting, and so even though I say that last year we did 278,000 background studies, 20,000 of those already had fingerprints and FBI record checks. So, you know, you get down to somewhere around 250,000. Mm-hmm. However, in a given year, there are many people who get multiple studies. And so because we're going to be not repeating studies on the same person over and over again, and there's a person we've done 128 background studies on. And so as we no longer need to repeat background studies, when I use a 250 people number, it's not really 250 people, it's 250 studies. And it's probably somewhere close to half of those people. So it's closer to 125 people will be fingerprinted.
Right. And Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, the bill has been significantly pared down since Mr. Kerber would have talked to you last fall. And this has been through civil law. I don't know if you were here when I said that initially, but it has been very vetted for those kinds of issues because I think many of us thought it was too expansive and were uncomfortable with that. So I don't know about that. Well, the number Mr. Kerber just explained, but this was originally going to be a bill where PCAs were going to get fingerprints that were going to be sent to the FBI. That is out of the bill. So we're not sending new stuff to the FBI, except I think very, very limited.
Okay, thank you. So that was going to be my next question was, if we don't keep them, how do we get rid of them at the FBI, but you're not sending them to the FBI? Is this still going to be even like for, I'm sorry, Mr. Kerber, will this still be even for like office jobs at nursing homes and different things like that?
Madam Chair and Representative Mullery, it kind of depends on the setting. The law generally requires that background studies are done on people who provide direct contact services. And direct contact services get defined as face-to-face care, training, supervision, consultation, counseling, or medication assistance. There's an exception to that for nursing homes. So in nursing homes, the legislature said it's all employees in nursing homes, including housekeeping staff, kitchen staff, bookkeepers in the back room. So nursing homes are a little different.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, if I could add to that too, Representative Mullery, as Mr. Cooper said at the outset, this bill doesn't expand who gets them.
No, but
Madam
Chair and Representative Liebling, I understand that, but it expands who, the number of people. I mean, we are expanding what's done to them, so it covers a lot of people. I guess that's all my question.
Thank you. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in the nursing home area, that's what I'm, you know, in my lifetime in the nursing home, I have had the background checks, and I'm happy to have them. And but I have had experience where we have hired people who are thieves and who have taken grandma's wedding rings and quilts and cash and everything else that she had left to her. And so this is an issue of much concern to me and should be to all of us that this does occur. So I am glad that it's everyone in the nursing home that has access to our residents. But what is the cost and who's paying for it?
Madam Chair and Representative Fritz, there are some changes that are underway. We received a federal grant a year and a half ago. It's a federal grant that's intended to enhance background studies in the long-term care area to be consistent nationwide. And so with the grant, we also received a software program. And the software program comes with the technical assistance and the software developers who are tailoring it to Minnesota. And so this does not come with any request for additional funding here for fee increases or general fund appropriation or anything like that. And we're using those federal dollars really to develop this system. We're going to be, as I mentioned, setting up fingerprint stations, you know, throughout the state, and so all the federal money is helping to fund that kind of an activity that's underway. But on the nursing home, on the issue of if somebody has a history of theft crimes, that's one of the things that's going to be changing here. In that I mentioned that we're going to be connected with MNSIS, with the Minnesota Court Information System, and the system we're developing is going to facilitate that. Actually, the legislature last year gave us the authority to develop that system, and it's going to be implemented as part of this package. Where on a regular basis, we're going to be getting more information about lower level offenses. Currently, you know, our background study law, and this is again something we're not changing, it's a disqualifying offense to have even a misdemeanor level theft. It's a disqualifier for 7 years. And it doesn't mean that somebody can't get a set aside of that disqualification and work. But frankly, those kinds of crimes are not reported to the BCA. And the BCA is where we're going for the criminal history information. But they are reported in MNSIS. And so as we're connected up with MNSIS, we'll be getting updated information about whether people are convicted of those low-level offenses. And they do have different significance. Certainly, I mean, one example I've given is if you're an outpatient chemical dependency treatment program for adult felon men, it's a different level of vulnerability than if you're working in a memory care in a nursing home. And so somebody who has stolen objects from another person, you know, may be more of a risk in the nursing home, even if they're low-level thefts, misdemeanor-level thefts, might be a different issue entirely than an outpatient treatment program.
Thank you.
Representative Schumacher. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Kerber, a couple years ago I had a bill that would expand the number of days that an employee could be away before another study would be kicked in, basically with the thought that a student goes away to school for the semester, comes back home and wants to work at their nursing home during the winter holiday or whatever and come back. If I'm reading this right, now through this language, the active roster would have that employee still on there, and so even though we didn't get the date that I wanted with that, the time span, that would actually wouldn't be a consideration anymore because they would be on the active roster, so that concern would go away. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher, that's an excellent point. And so the law started out that if somebody was gone for 45 days, break in service, and they came back, the employer had to do another background study because we had to find out did the person commit some crimes while they were gone for 45 days. Well, all of that's going to be changing here. And then that was changed to 90 days, and then there was another bill that changed it to 120 days, and that one didn't pass. But that all changes here because as long as somebody is on an employer's active roster, they can be gone for any length of time. It doesn't matter because being on an employer's active roster simply means that we will continue to get new criminal history information on that person. If they reoffend, we'll know about it, and then we'll contact the employer. If the person's been working, fine. If they haven't been working, fine. But we're going to notify the employer at that point. And so people who are summer employees, intermittent staff, migrant employees, all these things that we've been dealing with all these years, all those tensions to the system really go away.
Any other questions? Mr. Kerber, could you explain, though, you mentioned the PCAs are accepted. Can you tell us why?
Madam Chair, the PCAs are still included in this whole program. What we had been planning to do is to expand the background study categorically on PCAs to include FBI studies. What the goal here and the commitment we made for this grant funding is that we will try to get the authority to do FBI record checks on everybody we're studying. What we thought we would try this year is turn on the fingerprint machine with your permission, and then also get deeply into the water on the FBI record checks on a group of people that move from employer to employer and have multiple jobs, and so they're really a good test of the system. The concern, as you heard mentioned, about sending more records to the FBI, and the FBI is going to keep these records, it sort of became untenable this year. But we will be back with that proposal.
And thank you for that clarification. Yes, Representative.
And Madam Chair, if I could just comment on that, just to say again to members that this is one of those issues where we're really balancing the intrusiveness of the system for individuals against the very real public interest. And this is something that the Civil Law Committee wrestles with every single meeting, and this committee also wrestles with it in a number of different arenas. And you know, when I first agreed to carry the bill for the department, I told Mr. Kerber I was very uncomfortable with that, sending the stuff to the FBI, and I agreed to carry the bill anyway, and the Civil Law Committee was so uncomfortable with it that it's not there anymore, that new piece. So we're sort of trying to strike a balance here, and we realize that there's sensitivity about individual records. There certainly is. But there's also a lot of sensitivity about having our vulnerable patients exposed to people who really should not be taking care of them. So that's what this bill is attempting to do, is try to strike the right balance.
Thank you. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Liebling, apparently you got further with them when they came to me to author the bill. I said I wouldn't because of all those problems, and they didn't seem to want to change. So maybe when people started turning down the bill, they got the hint. So thank you for getting that straightened out.
Are there other questions? Does anyone wish to testify for or against the bill? Representative Abler.
Well, just one more question. I know, I mean, there's a privacy side, but then there's some things you're not going to find out about without that FBI thing, right? Mm-hmm. Just want to say that just so people have heard that side, just so they can understand the dichotomy. Mr. Kerber?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, yes. There always is that trade-off. Right? And as people, not everybody we're doing a background study on is a Minnesota native. And so people move more than they used to. And so there certainly is some, you know, chance that people have criminal records in other states. We are going to be categorically checking as part of the system that I mentioned that we're getting. We're going to be looking at the national sex offender registries. And so we'll at least know about sex offenses in other states. And that's all public information. And so, but there are some chances that we're going to miss some information. That's why we're going to be coming back in subsequent years to make that request.
Representative Liebling.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And part of this, the discomfort with this, Representative Abler, it's not so much that we would check. It's that if you send something to the FBI, they keep it and it becomes part of their permanent database. Unlike our BCA, where we can say, yeah, you can have the fingerprint, check it against your records, but then you got to destroy it at a certain point. That's the discomfort, that we don't have control over what they do with it once we send it.
Are there other questions? Representative Liebling, would you like to renew your motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I would renew my motion that House File 2467, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carried.
Okay, members, the next two bills that we're going to take up are the unsession bills from the department. And so even though I'm officially carrying them, they're really department bills for which I'm not making a pitch. So if it's okay with everybody, I'm just going to do that from here. And I sent you all an email letting you know that my intention is that these bills, which are supposed to be really just making technical changes, are supposed to be non-controversial. So my suggestion about how to proceed is that if any member has a concern about a provision, that we would simply take it out. So, obviously we all have to vote to take it out, but that's that would be my suggestion. I'm kind of stealing that from Representative Lincheski, who does that in the tax committee with technical type bills that the department brings forward, and they're supposed to be technical, they're supposed to be non-controversial. If in fact they're not, then we don't do them. So this is everybody okay with that? Representative Mack, does that sound reasonable? Okay, and members, even though I normally would be at the table with the testifier, I think that due to the nature of these bills, I think it's probably okay if everyone's all right that I would do it from here. So let's take up House File 2874. And I'm going to move that House File 2874 be re-referred to the General Register. And so we have Melissa Finnegan from the Department of Health, and she will walk us through the bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Melissa Finnegan. I'm the Legislative Liaison at the Minnesota Department of Health. House File 2874 is MDH's on-session bill, and to keep things moving quickly, I'm going to walk through this article by article. Article 1 is the Healthcare Administrative Simplification Act. The original Healthcare Administrative Simplification Act was enacted approximately 20 years ago, and as such, many of the provisions are now obsolete or have been superseded by others. To make the changes to this article, MDH worked with a large voluntary stakeholder organization called the Minnesota Administrative Uniformity Committee, and they reviewed the language and suggested technical and housekeeping revisions, which are what you see before you. These changes reflect needed revisions and updates to the ASA to ensure that it remains up to date, clear, and fosters continued improvements for more efficient, less costly exchanges of healthcare, business, and administrative transactions. Article 2.
Okay, and Ms. Finnegan, let me have you pause there for a second so that members can take a look at what's in front of them and see if they have any questions at this point, because I know we're moving through this very quickly, and I just want to make sure that if members do have a concern about something they see here, that we do know about it. So, any questions, members? Okay. No questions. Go ahead.
All right, moving on to Article 2. Article 2 is combining reports on vulnerable adults' maltreatment. Currently, both MDH and DHS are both designated as lead investigative agencies for cases of adult maltreatment under the Vulnerable Adults Act. Both lead investigative agencies are required to submit annual reports to inform the legislature and the governor about alleged maltreatment of vulnerable adults in facilities and programs that are licensed by those agencies. This proposal would combine those two reports into one comprehensive biennial report that can be accessed by consumers on both agency websites. We had to do a legislative change because there are current laws that require separate reports from each agency. By combining two reports into one report, we're going to reduce duplication of work across both agencies, and we're going to provide more comprehensive information to consumers in one place, allowing for better tracking and trending of maltreatment information. I would like to point out that although we are moving into a biennial report, there is a provision in here that requires agencies to provide statistical information annually on their websites.
All right. Any questions on that, members? Sounds like it'll save a few trees, too.
That is our hope, Madam Chair.
Yes. Okay. Go ahead, please.
Article 3 changes some references to tuberculosis. Sections 1, 2, and 3 remove unnecessary references where it says other communicable diseases and tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is a communicable disease, and we consider that to be redundant. Sections 144.443 and 444 are repealed in full. They are superseded by other statutes. And 144.45 is repealed because other means exist to achieve the intended outcome of that section.
Okay, questions? All right, not seeing any.
Moving right along to Article 4, which is formaldehyde. There are two sections in this article. Section 144.495 was enacted to address a formaldehyde off-gassing problem, primarily coming from the use of formaldehyde foam insulation. Since that statute was enacted, the industry has reformulated foam insulation to address that off-gassing problem. Therefore, the statute is no longer necessary. Similarly, Section 325F.181 has been made obsolete due to the fact that building product manufacturers have addressed the problems by changing the adhesives they use in making wood products.
Okay, are there questions on that, members? Yeah, Representative Abel.
Is that the end of the bill, or I have a question about a repeal?
No, we're doing article by article. I'm kind of pausing after each article to give.
Also, article. I think Article 5 is one I got a question. Sorry.
Okay, well, we're just doing 4 right now. So I know you're anxious to get on to Article 5, but
sorry to jump the gun, Matt.
Right, but I do have kind of a concern about this one, and that is that it may be that right now we don't need so much to have these rules, but say somebody was to use that foam that does the off-gassing and stuff, would the provision still apply?
Madam Chair, I'm going to bring down Tom Hogan, who is the director of our Environmental Health Division, to answer that question for you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Hogan. I'm the Director of the Environmental Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. In reference to your question, the United States Environmental Protection Agency is working on new requirements for standards for formaldehyde in products, and there's also requirements that requires the disclosure of formaldehyde-containing materials, which would still be in place. So those protections would still be available. And I think the real purpose behind removing these requirements is they reference outdated federal language as well.
Any other questions for members?
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler?
Well, I remember working on formaldehyde a long time ago, and I mean, there's no harm in keeping some protections, even if they're obviously, maybe it's on a direct staff to update the references and keep that. I think that'd be good. Someday we're going to wish we had that, and somebody will find some cheap little stuff somewhere, and they'll stick it in somebody's house and say, oh, it's not against the law.
Right. Thank you, Representative Abler. That's kind of where I'm going with this, too, because, and the bill itself doesn't, it just has a repealer, so it doesn't exactly tell us, or maybe it's on the back here.
It's on page 4R, Madam Chair.
Yeah, so it is here what the actual language is. But okay, so Representative Abler, do you want to make a motion to strike those?
Well, I'd like to move to delete whatever that
Article 4.
Well, that bit of it, and then but instruct staff to like to offer an amendment that they would in 144.495 on 4R that they would update the references to be current.
Okay. Can the staff maybe speak to that? Ms. Olson, maybe that's your area? Or could you? So what we're looking for here is whether we could update that. So the testifier mentioned there are federal references in the law that are outdated, and maybe those need to be updated instead of striking the language, instead of Article 4, which has the repealer, that we would, instead of repealing the language, simply update it so that it would be meaningful still. Is that something?
Madam Chair, we can delete the section being repealed from the bill, but if you want to modify the amendment, or modify the section of statute, we would need to do it through an amendment in the legislative process.
Okay. So, Representative Abler, do you want to just move to delete Section 2, lines 19.26?
Well, I can do that, but, Madam Chair, I mean, this could even, if we take it out, then it's not germane to anything, but if this is going to the floor, if we trusted the staff to get the right references, we could actually, my own amendment would be that they would just incorporate the right numbers into that section, and so I would move whatever lines those would be on page 4R with updated references. That way we've done something good. We've undone bad sections, Madam Chair. It's still an unsession.
Right. Okay. I mean, Representative Abler, I'm fine with that if the staff feels that they can, Ms. Aves or Ms. Olson, that you could do that for us.
They can do anything.
Madam Chair, what I understand is that you would, Representative Abler would like a floor amendment to modify some of the language in 144.495.
I was just going to trust you that you would do it right and we'd vote on the amendment sight unseen. I guess I want a floor amendment, Madam Chair.
Yeah, I don't think we can do it that way, unfortunately, but I get your point. I think the testifier is telling us that the language that's in here, the references are no longer correct. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
They need updating.
Yes.
And so we could direct staff to do that for us and give us an amendment for the floor to make sure those are correct. But I think we still do need to strike the repealer.
Well, Madam Chair, just to keep germaneness rules alive on the floor, we should not delete the repealer. And so then we would repeal it as the amendment.
Ah. Okay, so the floor amendment then would strike the repealer.
So we can do that jointly,
and
you
and the
I.
other language. Thanks. Great. Okay. All right. Thank you, Representative Abler.
I'll withdraw my amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay. So Representative Abler withdraws his amendment. Okay. Thank you. So we're on Article 5.
Yes, Madam Chair. Article 5 is our miscellaneous article. Section 1 simply removes a clause referencing smallpox, primarily because smallpox has been eradicated. There are several sections in the repealer. I am happy to walk through them one by one if you like. Otherwise, we can just speak about them in generally. There are several task forces in here that were included as part of the LCPFP revisions. They're no longer in use. There's 144.072. We fulfilled that criteria through rules. And I would like to draw your attention to my personal favorite, which is 145.132, authorized removal of the brain. That is a statute that allowed for the removal of the brain of a victim of Alzheimer's disease and its immediate transfer to Ramsey Medical Center. That was a research project that is now complete, and although the head note is very good, we no longer need the statute.
did I turn the brain?
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the question I had before. On page 1R, there's 62U.09. I actually remember passing that. I don't remember your name, but is there a reason that you want to get rid of that council?
Yes, we, the 62.09 is language referring to a lot of pilot studies that were tied to the Minnesota care reforms. Most of that has been repealed, and staff informed me that that section was no longer necessary.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Because it was the whole chapter, but did you ever have that council?
Ms. Finnegan.
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, I am not sure.
All right. Well, I remember when we did some health reform.
Representative Abler.
Sorry, Madam Chair. In 2008, this was something that was supposed to oversee some of what we were doing with all the transformation task forces and all that work that we did. And
Representative Abler, where are you exactly?
Oh, that's what the language is on 1R, 62U.09 in the repealer section.
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, now that I look at the language that you were looking at, yes, we did have this council, and it has not been in use since approximately 2010. We went through this when it was brought before the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy, and they also asked us about this council. The work and duties of those council have been taken up by other task forces and work groups in our health policy division. And since this one has not met in several years, we decided to repeal it.
Yeah. Okay, well, Madam Chair, I don't know if it's a good or a bad council, but it seems like our health department could be a much stronger department of health and focusing on these kind of things. And it seems the makeup of this council was a pretty good makeup. And I think if you were going to reduce some things, you might put these guys in charge of stuff compared to some of the people who were not engaging the public in these groups as they might. So maybe I'll just sit on it for now, but maybe on the floor I'll do some work and see if it's something we want to keep, because it's our job to help you do your job and actually to sometimes tell you what your job is. And so as a member who's been a lot of reform, that the more places or people are actually integrating these things, the better. And you know, the title of your department would imply that it's something you'd want to be doing. So I won't act on it now, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay, and Representative Abler, I mean, we're, again, if any member is not comfortable with something that's in here, we can take it out. It's, this is intended not to make people uncomfortable. And honestly, this is one agency's set of decisions about what they think is unnecessary. If we don't think it's unnecessary, then please make a motion.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess, let's just keep it for now, and if they can persuade me why it's not a good idea, that means they actually have to do it, and maybe this could make the department have to look at the councils that are doing things that we would find to be less valuable or less inclusive. Some of these issues about disparities, maybe these people would care about them, and we keep layering on new and more things. So I guess I'll move to delete it for now, Madam Chair.
I'll move to delete
62U09 repealer.
Okay, let's see. Maybe the staff can help us.
I don't know what page it's on. Oh, it's on page, it's actually line 22.7.
Okay, so on line 22.7, Representative Abler moves to delete 62U.09 from the repealer. Have I got that right, Ms. Aves?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so everyone understand that motion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay, and any other comments or questions about this article or about the bill? Because we've come to the end of the bill, I believe.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, seeing none. Okay, so I will renew my motion that House File 2874, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Ms. Finnegan.
No, that was this is the one we're doing now.
No.
Yeah.
1 hour.
All right, we're going to take up House File 2950.
There you go.
Welcome to the committee. And I will move that House File 2950 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. And then there is an amendment in here, members. In fact, there are two amendments. So we have the A1 amendment. And let's see.
I just got one.
Oh, okay. Okay, and members, I'm told the A2 was put in the wrong folder. So that was in the folder with the background studies bill, which explains to me now why I thought there was a second amendment to that bill when there wasn't.
2874.
So, 2950, yeah, so that was in the background. That was in the background studies bill.
One of those green things.
So, okay. So it's we've got the A1 and the A2 on this bill. So I'm gonna, and I think these are both department amendments, correct, Mr. Hosh? These are department amendments.
Madam Chair, I'm actually here just for Article 1 of the bill. So if there's amendments and they're dealing with other articles, then right. I'm not the one to speak to that.
Okay, well, members, I'm going to move the A1 amendment and to put the bill in the shape in which we'd like it to be discussed. All those in favor of the A1, please say aye. Ms. Aves.
I have an oral amendment.
Oops. Okay. Ms. Aves.
On page 1, line 27, strike the word group.
Okay. All right. So so I'm going to incorporate that on line 1.27, strike the word group.
Thank you.
And that's it, Ms. Aves? Okay. Sorry, members. So now we can vote on the A1 as with that amendment incorporated. So all those in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. And then I think we might as well go ahead and put on the A2 as well, Ms. Aves.
Madam Chair, I also have an oral amendment for the A2.
Please state your oral amendment.
On page 1, delete line 4.
Okay, on page 1, delete line 4. So I'll incorporate that, and then I'll move the A2 amendment with that incorporation. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay, now that we have the bill before us in the shape in which somebody wants it discussed, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Larry Hosh. I'm with the Department of Human Services. I'll be covering Article 1 of this bill, which deals with Children and Family Services. This unsession bill primarily focuses around four different areas when it comes to this, our priorities. One is programs that are unfunded and no longer operational. The second area is outdated and obsolete provisions within statute. The third, duplicative and redundant areas of statute. And lastly, erroneous or conflicting areas of statute. Because of the length of this bill and the number of provisions contained therein, I won't cover each and every single statute that we propose to change. I'll just try to provide the themes. If you would like me to cover each one, there's 31 instances just in Article 1 that I'm more than happy to go over, but I'll just give you examples of what we're trying to do. Under the unfunded programs, Article 1 proposes to strike references to five different programs that currently aren't funded and operational. An example, and these are all included in the repealer section, Section 12 of the article. An example is Family Friend and Neighbor Grant Program. This was last funded in the 2008-2009 fiscal year, no longer operational, and we have other programs that haven't been funded as far back as 2006. That we propose to strike. Outdated and obsolete references is the second area that we're dealing with. This has a total of 8 different repealers and then 7 different stricken references throughout statute. For example, sections 1-5 strikes references to the General Assistance Medical Care, GAMC, which many of you probably remember what happened legislatively with that program, and that is no longer operational. Another one is for a GRH rate. for Grace Home in Minneapolis. Grace Home is now closed and doesn't operate, so we don't need to have that GRH rate in statute. The third category within this article that we deal with is duplicative and redundant items of statute. For example, we repeal the single benefit demonstration project. This is now known as North Star, which is now a new chapter in statute, so there's no need to have this demonstration project in statute at the same time. Another example is duplicative language dealing with the basic sliding fee child care. Within the same section, we say that child care services must be available to families. We don't need to say that twice in the same section, so we just strike one of those references. And lastly is erroneous and conflicting areas of statute. We have two repeals and three fixes. One of them, just as recently as last year with the family cap repeal, when that was repealed, through a drafting error at the conference committee report, instead of repealing just the subdivision that dealt with the family cap, it was the entire section that was repealed. And there's multiple subdivisions within that section. We didn't want to do that, so we're just fixing those that erroneous repeal from last year. Other areas is we have a 2-year limit on hourly exemptions for job loss. We fixed that's conflicting with some of the other things in statute, so we propose to strike that. That's the general theme within Article 1, and I'm happy to discuss any specific provisions that the committee may want to discuss.
All right. Any questions from members? Representative Mack.
Madam Chair, and to Mr. Hosh, Representative Hosh, I'm not sure what the right way is to refer to outgoing members, Madam Chair. Just a question on 1R, that repealer there, is this an appropriate question? Or are we not on? Okay, I just want to make sure I'm speaking to the right sections. Just wondering, the at-home infant child care program, is that something that we have done away with and that was still just in the books? I'm trying to get a handle on that program and if that's transitioned into something else or if how that works and why we're repealing that right now.
Mr. Hosh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking at my notes here in this section. We do have policy staff here, too, that might be able to specifically address this. What I do know is that it was last funded in 2007, and it was funded at the tune of $1.1 million in 2007. Actual expenditures were less than $65,000. This was originally added to the basic sliding fee child care program by the 1997 legislature, and then eliminated in the 2003 session at that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Other questions from members?
Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Abler?
Well, at that same point, I was just checking on something else I've passed that I maybe want to rescue out here. But a little busy people at the department there just appealing all these good things. That donated dental thing, the at-home infant thing, that came from Doc Mulder. It had a lot of merit, and for some reason it's kind of fallen out of favor. We just haven't given it money. I don't know what you were saying, but I think we should just keep the framework there just in case you want to. And I don't know if Representative Mack, I'm repeating what she said, but I would like to move to keep it.
And Representative Abraham, I'm not sure exactly what you're speaking to now.
Page 1R.
Okay, so you're speaking to
the repealer is actually fascinating to read about all this stuff. It's just numbers.
Right, but you're referring to the at-home infant child care program?
Okay. Right. And Madam Chair, the idea was with what child care costs and what marginal monies they might get, that if you put some money into this and people actually stay home with their own child and they get a year. It was kind of a bit controversial, but it seemed to work out, and then we just quit funding it. So I like to move just to keep it, and then it's a good idea that might come back when people kind of have a new.
Okay, so Ms. Abes, can you or Ms. Olson, can you help us here what we have to do to?
Madam Chair,
Ms. Abes,
I believe the instruction would be on page 14, line 22, delete 119B, .035, semicolon.
So, I'm sorry, do you repeat that? Page 14.
Line 22.
Line 22.
Delete 119B, .035, semicolon.
Okay, does everybody have that? And everybody knows what we're doing?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Could Mr. Hosh or somebody talk about the compulsive gambling? Is that done somewhere else? We get rid of the report, and is that duplicative of what we're already doing? We still care about it. We just do it somewhere else. That's on line 1R. There's a, or page 1R, there's a report on compulsive gambling. Later, there's some more compulsive gambling stuff that's in here.
Mr. Hosh.
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, that's not in Article 1, and as we have other testifiers from the poll, other articles, I would...
Oh, I'm sorry. We're going
to assume we can answer that.
I apologize.
That's all right, Representative Abler. I was confused by that, too. I guess their appealers are not really in order with the article.
No,
it's the
question. Okay, thanks,
Matt. Very understandable mistake. Okay, but we'll keep that in mind for when we get to it. Go ahead, Mr. Hosh.
Madam Chair, that's all I have
okay.
For the committee.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Let's move on. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Gio Gohase. I'm with the Healthcare Administration at the Department of Human Services. I'll be reviewing briefly Article 2, which is related to Healthcare Administration. Similar to Mr. Hosh, I have these in kind of groups. Most of them are even more technical in nature than his, so I'll begin with those. There are seven sections in Article 2 that eliminate cross out outdated effective dates. So something that says, you know, effective January 2007, simply crossing out that type of language. There are several old reports that are being repealed. Three sections in Article 2 and 5 repealers have to do with old reports that have due dates that have passed. So that, like I said, that's three sections in Article 2 and 5 repealers. There are then three sections related to federal approval. Section 4 relates to some language directing us to get federal approval, which we did, and so we no longer need the language directing us to do so. Section 15 is a provision that did not receive federal approval, so we're striking that from statute. Did not require federal approval, my apologies. And Section 18 is a section that did not receive federal approval,
Let me just have you pause for a second, because I see members flipping madly through the bill, and I'm kind of lost, too. So are we talking about Article 2? We are.
That is correct, Minister.
Right. And then can you direct us to the... Well, maybe you're going a little too fast for us here.
I'd be happy to slow down.
Okay, well, What page are you looking for, Representative Mack?
We're just skipping from one section to the next. I'm just going back.
Okay. I don't know if you have the pages in front of you, but if you do, you could maybe provide them to us as you go through.
I can attempt to cross-reference as I go through.
Okay. Please proceed.
I hope so.
Would you prefer me to do the federal portion again, since that seemed to be where people are flipping pages?
Yeah, I think that would be wise.
Okay, Section 4, as I mentioned, which is on page 18 of the bill at the bottom. That language is really just striking our direction to seek federal approval. Just a couple words that are being stricken there. Section 15, which you can see on page 30. It starts on page 29. That would direct the department to seek federal approval for something that in the end did not require federal approval. So we are simply striking that language. Section 18, which can be found on page 33 and continues on through page 35, is related to a section that we were asked to seek federal approval on before implementation, and we did not receive federal approval. So because of that, we're removing the language because that section was never implemented. And then there were a couple other miscellaneous sections that I was going to mention briefly. And so Section 2 of the bill. Which is on page 15 for members' purposes, is some dish requirements that was only effective in October of 92 to December of 92, so we've stricken that. Section 3 of the bill, which can be found on page 18, allowed Itasca County to temporarily be a demonstration project, but now they're considered a county-based purchaser, so there's no need for them to be a demonstration project anymore. Moving on to Section 6, which can be found on the bottom of page 19 and continuing on to page 20, is some expired managed care effective dates and withholds. And then Section 8 is some time-limited MRC reductions through 2002, so we struck that because we've clearly passed 2002. Section 8 is on page 25. And then there are two more repealers I'll mention briefly that were dental grant programs that were enacted but no longer received federal funding, so we've repealed those. Lastly, I'll just mention there are two repealers that I have not yet mentioned, which are 256B.69. Subdivision 5E is related to a MRC requirement that was only in effect from 99 to 2001. And that same section of law, but Subdivision 6C was a dental demonstration project that expired in 2006. So largely pretty technical things in Article 2.
All right, thank you. Any questions for members? Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Reese. And this might actually be a question for MDH rather than you. And I noticed in a summary of the repealers from House Research, the MDH Technology Assessment Review Panel, which reviews disputes over health plans benefits for technology-assisted persons. As I recall, that was implemented because determining medical medical necessity by some was being interpreted really narrow, like they might need technology to hold their job, but could they live without it? Maybe, you know, yes, no. And so has that been replaced with something else, or is there someone from the Department of Health who could address that repealer?
Representative Loeffler, we're on the Department of Human Services bill right now.
Right, and it's in here under the repealers under Article 2 in Section 19. It's in the it's listed in the House Research Summary as being part of the DHS session bill.
Mr. Race, is there something?
Representative Loeffler, could you mind giving me the statutory site, and I can look on my notes here and see if
It's 256.9691. And maybe there's an alternative process that's been implemented since. I just was curious since it was an MDH provision.
Okay, Mr. Race?
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, some of these provisions that are in Article 2 actually came from Senate Council, and that was one of them. And so when we were asked to review if these had any effect on the Health Care Administration, we did direct Senate Council to say that that was a Department of Health statute and that we would not be able to comment on that. So I apologize.
Okay, we'll seek a friend's advice as this moves on.
Okay, and Representative Loeffler, if you want to remove it, we can remove it. So we're kind of getting short of time here too. So if you're not comfortable with it, it doesn't have to be removed. So we could.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will just assume that the Department of Health did review this and was consulted, and that there's an alternative process.
All right. Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair, I think
we're finished with Article 2.
Madam Chair.
And Representative Abler.
Well, thanks. I was just looking at this donated dental thing, and we're just going to do some homework and see if it matters or not. But on 26R and 27R, there's two dental things there which may have merit, and we'll just take that up on the floor. But there is one other one which I don't know why they want to take it out. It's on 31R. The cost containment efforts about alternative and complementary and access to care.
Okay.
Is that yours? That's the right topic.
Rips and Baylor, if you could just give me the statutory set.
Oh, 256B043. Mm-hmm. It's on line page 31R.
Right, and that's in the same place. It's on page 35 of the bill, right at the bottom, and right at the bottom of where the repealer is in the bill is on page 35, and
but the text is
and on page 31R at the top is what Representative Abler is referring to. Representative Abler, do you want to make a motion to take that out?
Well, this actually is a really good section, and if they haven't used it, they ought to. If you're trying to get quality and cost, some of these methods are...
And Representative Abler...
You're out of time. I'll just move to delete it.
I'm just happy to have you move to delete it.
Madam Chair.
On page 35 of the bill, so let's see.
I'll move whatever you say.
Okay. Ms. Aves, if you could help us with this one, I just want to make sure I've got the right... This is, I think it's was 256-9691. The next one, 256B043. And that would be on page 35. So we would be striking that reference to 256B043. Ms. Aves, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay, so I think we're done with this article. Thank you. And moving on to Article 3. Welcome to the committee, and we are going to have to speed things up just a bit here to make sure we can get through. Welcome.
Madam Chair, I am Thomas Reuter. I'm the Director of Operations Support for State Operated Services with the Direct Care and Treatment Administration at the Department of Human Services. Joined by me today is Gary Cox, who's with the Children's Mental Health area, and Gary will lead us off in talking about Article 3, which is provisions related to both of our areas in chemical and mental health, as well as direct care and treatment. And Gary will be talking specifically about the children's mental health provisions within this article.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gary Cox, again, with the Children's Mental Health Division, and I'm the manager there. The Article 3, in general, is repealing obsolete, unnecessary language, language that has been updated in rule, erroneous references, and in a couple of cases, references to sections that have already been repealed and were missed in the repealer last year. Basically, what we've been doing here is, and most of this language is in the children's mental health area, which is why I'm here instead of the adult mental health division. A lot of this is updating clinical standards. Language was updated in rule in 2011, and we're trying to correct the citations in statute to make those consistent. There's a number of repealers here that were from the Children's Mental Health Act, which was enacted first in 1989. And as you can imagine, a lot of things are obsolete from that, particularly as we have moved mental health services from a county social services-based kind of model to integrating with healthcare. If there's any particular questions on any of the sections in there, I can certainly address them.
All right. Questions for members? Representative Albright.
On page 40, line 40.20. Yeah, I understand that it may be redundant, but it, in the case of data privacy, I'm just wondering if striking "and the commissioner shall not collect individual screening results" is justified. And so I'm asking, the question I would ask is that provision reinforced through some other section of the code or this bill, or if you could explain to me the rationale for why that part of the sentence is stricken.
Mr. Cox?
Madam Chair, this is being deleted because it's essentially an obsolete prohibition. It's the only children's mental health service whereby the department is prohibited from collecting evaluation data that would allow us to evaluate performance of our grantees and our providers. It's really an anomalous kind of provision in there, and we collect data on every other grant and every other service that we provide. And this one, with that language, that prohibition in there as it stands, we are unable to determine whether or not our grantees and our providers are performing with regard to the children's mental health screening.
All right. Well, Ms. Representative Albright, that sounds kind of substantive to me, not technical. And so I'd be happy to remove that if you wish. And just to remind members, this is going to civil law as well, but if you want to strike that, we could just... sir? Yeah, and that is one of the reasons it's going to civil law.
If you'll accept that as an amendment, I'd appreciate that.
Absolutely. So Representative Albright moves to strike the, or to reinsert the language, I guess, on line 40.20. Ms. Aves, would that be the motion?
Yes, ma'am. It would be on page 40, okay, line 20, reinstate the stricken language.
Okay. So everybody understands? All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay. We only have five more minutes, members, so we need to kind of move along. Any other questions about this section?
Or Madam Chair, do you want me to address the state operated services portion?
Yes. Can you do it very, very quickly?
I believe I can.
Oh, and Representative Loeffler has a question. Representative Loeffler.
Actually, there's a couple of repealers here that I'm not very comfortable with, and they've been mostly describing the content of the bill, but there's a lot of policy being deleted here as well. One is the annual report on compulsive gambling, which is 245.981. It's page 16R of the repealers. Given that we are now, as I understand it, going to video gambling via the lottery and some other things, there's some controversy.
We don't need to debate it. If any member's uncomfortable, just please move to strike it. We will strike
it. I will move to delete the repeal of 245.981.
Okay, and Ms. Aves, if you could help us out here.
On line 50.22, I believe.
Line 50. Madam
Chair, on page 50, line 22.
On 50, line 22, and?
Delete 245.981, semicolon.
Okay, everybody have that, and Representative Loeffler is moving to delete that repealer on the compulsive gambling report. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails.
And Madam
Chair, Loeffler,
having once served on the claims committee, and I suspect they haven't looked at it, I would move to delete the deletion of 246.16, which deals with unclaimed money or personal property, and that is also on line 50.22.
Okay, so on line 50.22, 245.16, I'm sorry, 246.16, Ms. Aves, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so everybody have that? All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Anything else? Okay, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 17 is the repealer section, and there's a large number of repealers here related to state-operated services. We continue to update our operating statutes, and as many of you know, the legislature adopted bills in 2005 and 2013 repealing or eliminating statutes or laws that no longer apply to this part of the Department of Human Services. Today, we again ask for your support with repealing or modifying provisions within this bill. Of the laws that are being presented for repeal are those that were written in the early and mid-1900s that governed the operation of the organization during a different era when such laws were necessary, but now we have other portions of statute of which we operate under. Our earliest statute being presented for repeal was adopted in 1907. Today, these laws are superseded by other state and federal law or apply to programs or facilities that no longer operate, are in existence, or practices that no longer exist. In addition, some of the statutes apply to initiatives that have long been completed. And I can answer specific questions if people have them.
Are there questions from members? All right, I'm not seeing any, so thank you very much. Next. And members, we can go maybe just 5 minutes over, and we have one other quick task, so welcome to the committee. We need to kind of move quickly here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Stacey Meyer-Twight with the Department of Human Services. I'll be covering Article 4, which begins on page 50. Moving rather quickly, sections 1 through 6 eliminate references to county contracting in our elderly waiver and alternative care program sections of statute. County contracts with providers of all home and community-based services were eliminated in a different section of statute effective January 1st, 2014. And with the elimination of those contracts, the ability for counties to negotiate rates is also eliminated in these language changes. Rates set for the EW and AC program are set by the state, which is current practice. Section 7 is a long list of repealers, and I'm going to categorize those into four categories. The first bulk of those repealers remove references to old sections of rate-setting statute for nursing facilities and intermediate care facilities for persons with developmental disabilities, or ICFDDs. These subdivisions and rules have been replaced with newer rate increase language or different authority for rate-setting in statute. Much of the language in this category relates to the old Rule 50 methodology of rate setting for nursing facilities, and that is the bulk of the language, I believe, in the repealers section. The second category is removing old instructions to the commissioner for one-time legislative reports, recommendations, and directions to the commissioner to submit amendments to the federal government or promulgate rules. Many of these sections are instructions from the 1990s and 1970s. Thirdly, we're removing old demonstration and pilot projects that are no longer operating or no longer funded or did not receive federal approval. These include the consumer-directed home care project and self-directed support options, and MINDO, or the Minnesota Disability Health Options Program, which is no longer operational. These pilot programs have either been incorporated into other programs, as is the case for our self-directed projects, or were never approved by the federal government. Lastly, we're removing repealers related to old sections of statutes for persons who are deaf or hard of hearing. The first repealer, 256.971, requires DHS to maintain a registry and provide services to people who are deaf or hard of hearing. This language originally passed in 1957 and has not been amended since the 80s. The gathering of a registry is unnecessary, as many people who are deaf or hard of hearing do not require services from the state. There was never a reasonable mechanism to find people who are deaf or hard of hearing. DHS certainly maintains information on people who come to us for services, but it is a small proportion of people throughout the state who are deaf or hard of hearing.
All right, thank you. Questions for members? All right, not seeing any. Okay, and Mr. Kerber, really, really quick.
Madam Chair, members, Article 5 starts on page 54. There's one section that's dealing with the Data Practices Act, and what we're doing is repealing duplicative language in a couple provisions. The next sections, 2, 3, 4, and 5, deal with the Human Services Licensing Act, and what's being done in here we're removing a report to the legislature there's a provision that timed out in August of 2013 that we're removing. There's also some removal of language about child care training, both for child care centers and family child care. The last couple of years, the legislature spent a lot of time on clarifying the training requirements. This is language that's no longer necessary. Sections 6 and 7 are in the Human Services Background Study Act. And what it's doing, it's outdated language that relates to earlier times when counties did more of the background studies for adult foster care providers, and then that transferred to the state. And so Section 7 is transfer period language for both child foster care and adult foster care. Section 8 is amending the Maltreatment of Minors Act and removing language that required a report to the legislature in 2007. And then there are four repealers in here, and Madam Chair, Ms. Aves has a slight amendment. I think maybe we went just a little bit too far on one of the repealers. I'll explain the first two are repealers that deal with interpretive guideline language that's
okay,
not used.
Okay, Mr. Kerber, if we're gonna take out what's in this bill, we don't need to discuss that. Ms. Aves, can you just tell us what needs to be modified here, and we can make that amendment?
Madam Chair and members, the amendment will be on page 67, line 3, to delete 245A.655.
Okay, is that it, Ms. Aves?
Yes.
Okay, so members have that? So we're just, we're not repealing something that the bill was repealing, and I think that we're probably all okay with that. Representative Albright?
Mr. Kerber, on line, page 61, Madam Chair, I have a question in terms of...
Okay, Representative Albright, we need to vote on this motion we're making right now, though, first, if we could. So, members, on 67.3, deleting the reference to, in the repealer to 645A.655, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kerber, on page 61... note that the language with regard to training for infant shaking has been deleted. I'm just wondering what replaces it.
Mr. Kerber?
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, if you look up at paragraph C and, or B and C, paragraph B talks about sudden unexpected infant death reduction training, and then paragraph C is abusive head trauma. Training. And abusive head trauma is the new term for shaken baby training, so or shaken infant. So this B and C were added last legislative session, and D could have been removed, but was not.
Okay. All right, Representative Loeffler, and then we've got to vote on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's too bad that Representative Fritz, who worked really hard on this language last year, isn't here, but I suspect we had a fiscal note with it, and I'm a little uncomfortable taking away the, you know, the video training. If you hire somebody, you can just show them the training.
Oh, Representative Loeffler, if you don't want it in there, just move to take it out, please.
I'd move to take out Section 3 on page 61.
Okay.
And Section 4 on page 62. And I think the same thing is on Section 5 on page 62 to 63. And they can...
Okay, could you please repeat that, Representative Loeffler?
Sure. I'd move to delete Article 5, Sections 3, 4, and 5.
Article 5, Sections 3, 4, and 5. Everybody got that? Okay. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay. Other questions, members? So I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2950, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. Oh, I'm sorry, to Civil Law. Be referred to Civil Law. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you. House File 435. Representative Schoen, you can just stay there if you wish. This is Representative Schoen's bill. Agreement that we have is to, I think everybody's aware, we're going to move this amendment. There's the DE2, and I can move that, or Representative Schoen, if you want to. I don't think... Okay, so I'm going to move the DE2 amendment. And what this is doing, members, as we said in our posting, is basically it's just... putting some language on the bill that makes it a vehicle. We're not trying to do anything substantive today. We're moving the bill to the General Register. So first I would move the DE2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. And then I'm going to move to, unless Representative Schoen wants to make the motion, move the bill as amended to the General Register. Okay, Representative Schoen moves to that House File 435 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. And so, members, this is our, we may meet again. I'm not saying this will be our last meeting for the session, but our main work is done because we're at second deadline. We're not meeting again this week, so I just, even though we're a bit over time here, I just want to take the opportunity to again thank all of you for your really hard work this session. It's been really, I think it's been a very productive and obviously quick 4 weeks. I especially want to thank the staff who've worked very, very hard. Both the partisan staff, the nonpartisan staff who've been with us all these many, many hours, and especially Ms. Sando and Mr. Bergeron and our pages. Everybody's done just tremendous work this session. So thank you very, very much. We are adjourned.